The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. 2020, the last year for which the CDC provides stats, the U.S. maternal mortality rate rose to 23.8 from 20.1 in 2019, with black women nearly three times as likely to die as white women. That's just one reason the title Aftershock is so fitting for the recently released documentary women's health advocate Tanya Lee Lewis co-directed and co-produced with Paula Iselt. The film shines a light on Omari Maynard and Bruce McIntyre, who both lost their partners in childbirth and went on to turn their grief into advocacy and activism. How can we prevent these avoidable deaths is the question they are now working to answer, as is the documentary itself. Lee, a former human rights attorney, first began asking herself this question when she became a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health. When her children's book, Please, Baby, Please, co-authored with her husband Spike Lee, was released, they asked her to help raise awareness about infant mortality. Lee soon found herself engrossed in the women's health world, which led her to increasingly engage in conversations around maternal mortality and black maternal mortality specifically. In an interview with Oprah Daily, Lee discussed what she learned while filming Aftershock, including what every woman can do to protect her health and ways we can all help combat maternal mortality. What drew you to co-direct and co-produce Aftershock? I had just finished producing another film and met Paula Iselt, my co-director and co-producer in the film. She was equally passionate about maternal health and black maternal health. We met in November 2019, and Shimoni Gibson passed away October 2019 after giving birth to her son. Shimoni's family held a celebration of life for Shimoni called Aftershock. They sent an invitation out on social media inviting people to come to the celebration and to be in conversation about the black maternal epidemic in this country. So we reached out, and Shawnee Gibson, Shimoni's mother, and Omari allowed us to come and film. That really was the beginning of the film as it is, being there, seeing the celebration of life for Shimoni. Seeing Omari engage in conversation with other men who have lost partners and wives in the situation. They became the backbone and the fabric of the film. How did you develop enough rapport and trust with Omari and Bruce to get them to be so vulnerable and let you into the grieving space that they were in? Bruce, similar to Omari, held a press conference in the Bronx almost a week after Amber passed away to demand accountability, but also to be engaged in conversation with the community about what is happening with black maternal health in this country. They already wanted to have this conversation. We showed up, we talked to them, we listened, and we really just followed their lead. Myself, Paula, Shawnee, Omari, and Bruce were all passionate about the idea that black women are dying from preventable causes from childbirth complications. We have to get the word out as much as possible. Omari and Bruce represent an idea that is much talked about, of men showing up for black women in this fight. Do you think that if we're going to effectively combat maternal mortality, the onus has to be on people other than black women? Well, I think that black maternal health is not just a woman's issue. It's not just a black woman's issue. Black maternal health is an issue for all women. It's an issue for men and extended families. Everyone is impacted when a woman dies. There's a ripple effect. It is incumbent upon everybody to figure out what they can do. The healthcare system and healthcare providers have a major role they're going to have to figure out. Black women have to arm ourselves, be in conversation, and think about how we navigate the system and find the best situation for ourselves. Then everybody else has to figure out what they're doing as well to make for better outcomes. In the film, Bruce was working on an initiative to build a birthing center in the Bronx, and there's a story of the woman who gave birth in a birthing center as well. Do you think new spaces outside of hospitals where we can reimagine what giving birth looks like is another way to combat maternal mortality? I think that in general in the United States, we have to reimagine what birth looks like. Every woman in every family has to figure out what is the best birthing situation for her, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. For some people, a hospital is the right birthing space, and they should be able to do that. For others, a birthing center with midwives and doulas is the right space. And for others, it could be at home with the right support. So I think it's really about making sure women understand that there are choices out there and that each individual has to find the right support for her. Do you think that this film is particularly timely in light of Roe v. Wade being overturned? The fact that we're still talking about the autonomy of women's bodies, I do worry. I believe there was a study that just came out that said with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we're going to see more maternal death. I do see that coming. I see delayed care for women. I see poor care for women. I see the potential for the criminalization of women. If you have a miscarriage and there's a question about that. So I do worry very much about this decision and the impact it's going to have on women, especially Black women. We know that laws are applied in unequal ways. I think this will harm us more than others. It's a dark day, but I remain optimistic because the fight's not over. What do you hope people take away from this film? Any actions you hope are inspired as a result of watching it? I hope people come away ready to have lots of conversations about lots of different things. I'm gratified because there are conversations that are already happening that I wouldn't have even anticipated, like men talking about paternal mental health. I hadn't really thought about that as something that would come out of this film, so I don't know that I have a specific takeaway for people other than to figure out where they fit and plug into this conversation about maternal health, and in particular, Black maternal health in this country. I believe we all have a role to play in some way, in some form. It can be as simple as finding the best birthing option for you. It could be supporting Bruce in his birthing center, or the womb bus that he now has in the Bronx, which is women's healthcare on wheels. Or it could be supporting Shani and Omari and their Araya Foundation, which is about art and healing. Or it could be about getting out in the streets and doing the work. I think it's just a matter of figuring out where you fit in. In the film, Shani Gibson, an activist and social worker, spoke about having worked in the reproductive health space prior to her daughter's death. Yet that wasn't enough to combat the situation affecting her own family. Aside from education, are there any other tangible tools you would recommend to women who are pregnant or thinking about it to implement into their medical care? It's such a hard thing because Shimoni and her family did everything they could do, but I would still say try to educate yourself as much as possible. Be a consumer when it comes to your healthcare provider. Really make sure the person who is interfacing with you is somebody who you feel really good and comfortable with. Even if it's down the line, if they don't feel like they're the right person, you can still pivot and find the right healthcare provider. Yes, sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it takes time. Yes, you don't feel like doing it, but it could be helpful to you. Try to make sure you have the right support around you and the right advocacy for you so you can birth in the way that is best for you. The other thing to really be on alert for is postpartum care. Pay attention to how you're feeling, and if you're not feeling right and someone blows you off, demand that they pay attention or go find somebody who will. Do you have any updates on how Omari and Bruce have been doing since you wrapped filming? Omari and Bruce are doing really great. The kids are growing and are beautiful. Omari talks about how the community has really come out in support of him and his family and just how healing that has been. He's been able to share in that by reaching out to other fathers. He and Bruce were just recently at the White House talking to groups of men, and they have initiatives that they're working on together. Bruce, as I mentioned, has the womb bus in the Bronx. He continues to work on getting the birthing center open, and I'm sure he will do it. He worked on legislation in New York State so that we could have midwife-facing birthing centers. They both just keep working. I expect to see a lot from them. This interview has been edited and condensed for clarity. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, Here's How Polyamory Works. As anyone who's ever been single knows, it can sometimes feel like the world is built for couples, with forever and ever upheld as the gold standard of romantic success. Yet the practice of non-monogamy or exploring relationships outside of the traditional two-people-only model may be more common than you think. According to one 2016 survey of U.S. Census-based data, 1 in 5 out of nearly 9,000 single people said they had engaged in consensual non-monogamy at least once in their lives. Why polyamory and open relationships have been portrayed on shows like The Politician and House of Cards, and teased yet never fulfilled in Three's Company's scintillating Where the Kisses Are Hers and Hers and His theme song, you might not have met an openly polyamorous person in real life before. Whether you're merely curious or interested in trying it for yourself, here's a brief explanation of what polyamory is, as well as a few terms common to the poly community. What's the difference between polyamory and an open relationship? They're similar in that they're both forms of consensual non-monogamy, meaning all parties involved know what's going on and thus nobody is cheating on someone. I would say that open relationship is a broad overarching category under which polyamory fits, says Drs. Elizabeth Eli Sheff, author of The Polyamorous Next Door, and a leading academic and legal expert on polyamory. Polyamory is more specific in that it implies emotional intimacy among partners who all know about each other. According to Dr. Eli, an open relationship or open marriage often entails one or both partners dating someone else outside their serious partnership or inviting in additional sex partners in a situation often defined as swinging. Polyamory, she says, is closer to a concept of group marriage in that it emphasizes emotional intimacy and long-term relationships. In the poly world, marriage is not emphasized, she continues. Polyamory may involve one person with four partners, but they're also primary partnered with someone who has two partners, and that person might be partnered with a fellow poly who isn't interested in keeping score of how many lovers they have. If reading that leaves you overflowing with questions like, but what about sexually transmitted diseases, and how does everyone manage these amorphous relationships without getting overwhelmed and exhausted, don't worry. Ethically non-monogamous people give those concerns plenty of thought. In fact, polyamorous people arguably have to give more thoughtful consideration to what they want and need from relationships than most conventionally coupled people do. It's all part of keeping everyone involved feeling safe and respected. Do polyamorous relationships have rules? Yes, but any set of rules is entirely unique to the poly person in question and their respective partners. Setting rules is particularly common and valuable when a person or couple is first starting to dip their toe into the polyamory world. If people continue in a polyamorous lifestyle, they often move less to a rule-based agreement and more towards acting in ways they know will make them all feel well-treated, Dr. Eli explains. A common beginner's agreement includes a veto rule, in which one or both primary partners reserve the right to nix the other's potential lover. However, Dr. Eli says the veto rule can lend itself to manipulation through overuse. Further, she adds long-term poly relationships tend to work best when everyone involved likes each other's metamours. The definition of metamour is a partner's partner. For example, if you have a husband and he has a girlfriend, but you and the girlfriend are not romantically involved with each other, she would be your metamour. If they don't, it causes a lot of strain, she says. Ultimately, those relationships need to be kept separate, which is much easier in a long-distance relationship, or over the years, the metamours come to like each other better. Otherwise, someone's relationship in that configuration breaks up. Be honest about what you're doing is probably one of the few rules that is nearly universal among polyamorous folks, Dr. Eli adds. Also, negotiate. Communicate about what you want and make agreements with all of your partners involved. How do polyamorous people protect themselves from STIs? Many, though not all, people in polyamorous relationships share what's called a safer sex agreement with those they're involved with, which is a negotiation about who they will and will not be having unprotected sex with. If you're fluid bonded with one person, you would generally use barrier methods, such as a condom or dental dam, when you're with other partners in order to protect that person from sexually transmitted infections, Dr. Eli says. The definition of fluid bonded is an agreement in which two people actively choose to share bodily fluids via unprotected sex. While this term is not unique to the poly community, it presents itself when multiple partners are in the picture. Do polyamorous people get jealous? Jealousy is a natural human emotion, and no one is wholly exempt from feeling it, no matter what type of relationship they're in. Plenty of polyamorous people struggle with feelings of jealousy over their primary, secondary partners or metamours, or their metamours primary and so on. It may flare up when their primary's new feelings for another intensify or during a period of personal insecurity. However, Dr. Sheff does posit that a polyamorous person's relationship to their own jealousy may differ from that of someone who feels it within a two-person bond. Research indicates that people in monogamous relationships actually have more jealousy than people in polyamorous relationships, she says. At first, that seemed counterintuitive to me, but the more I thought about it, it made sense. In monogamy, you're not supposed to notice or be attracted to other people, so everything can potentially make a monogamous person jealous. And in the fairy tale version of love, jealousy is evidence that your partner loves you. By design, polyamorous relationship structures can allow more space for a neutral acknowledgement of one's jealousy. That said, Dr. Sheff dismisses the notion that poly people are more emotionally evolved than monogamous ones. It assumes that if everyone were evolved, they'd all be polyamorous. She doesn't agree. I think some people are deeply monogamous. I would call it a relational orientation. And it doesn't mean that someone is small and grasping. It means when they really fall for someone, they're very oriented toward that person and no one else. And I think the opposite is true, that some people are polyamorous by relational orientation, and even if they really love someone, they'll always be wanting multiple partners, she continues. It's not a symbol of lack in their two-person relationship, it's more an effect of how they're wired. Polyamorous people don't have commitment issues. Well, some undoubtedly do, just like some monogamous people have commitment issues, but that's not what drives people into a polyamorous lifestyle. In fact, Dr. Eli has interviewed people who have been maintaining poly relationships for upwards of 50 years together. Polyamorous people do develop deep emotional intimacy, in part because they have to think about themselves and what they want, and get to know themselves before they talk to their partners about it, she says. It's probably easier to develop that if you kind of make up the rules as you go. In a monogamous relationship, there are so many role models in real life and songs and movies, but polyamory has very few. So for people to improvise, they've got to think about it and talk about it. That honest communication leads to emotional intimacy. Want to try polyamory? Don't forget to tell your partner. Seriously, it's called consensual non-monogamy for a reason. Negotiate before acting, Dr. Eli warns. Because if you come back and say, honey, I hooked up with this person and I'm so excited about them, let's open up our relationship, honey is not going to feel safe or trusting. You may also want to read up on the topic beforehand, whether you're broaching it to a partner or you're single. Respected books include More Than Two, A Practical Guide to Ethical Polyamory, The Ethical Slut, A Practical Guide to Polyamory, Open Relationships and Other Adventures, and Opening Up, A Guide to Creating and Sustaining Open Relationships. Those who have or are thinking of having children may want to read Dr. Eli's Stories from the Polycule, Real Life and Polyamorous Families. Supporting a polyamorous loved one is easy. If a friend or family member comes out to you as polyamorous, being welcoming and non-judgmental goes a long way. Don't question the reality of it. This must be a phase. You must be delusional, Dr. Eli says. She also recommends inviting their partner or partners to events like a barbecue or potluck, and even consider giving that person a small gift to make them feel welcome. Ultimately, it's important to remember that polyamorous relationships are relationships, even if they look a little different from yours. As Dr. Eli says, relationships in general are fluid. Even monogamous relationships change or end or grow. Our next article by Lauren Smith McDonough and Janaya Wecker is titled 35 American Towns That Look Straight Out of Europe. Before you shell out hundreds, or most likely thousands of dollars traveling across the ocean, you may want to look closer to home. There are plenty of cities in the United States that look just like those quaint, historic destinations in Europe. You're going to want to go to all of them, so start saving now. Number 1, Frankenmuth, Michigan. Back in 1845, this village was founded as a Bavarian mission colony for Lutherans, and today it's known as Michigan's Little Bavaria. The town is famous for Bronner's Christmas Wonderland, which claims it's the largest Christmas store in the world. Number 2, Leavenworth, Washington. Just 2 hours from Seattle is Leavenworth, which looks like it was plucked out of Germany and dropped in the mountains of Washington. It's modeled after a small Bavarian village and is the dreamiest escape, especially during the holidays. Number 3, Healdsburg, California. If you've ever wanted to visit Tuscany, Healdsburg is your next best bet. It falls along the same line of latitude as the Italian region, so it has a similar climate and grows a ton of Tuscan wine varieties. The town's Italian cuisine is also not to be missed. Number 4, Solvang, California. Known as the Danish capital of America, this charming town is filled with quaint shops and even an iconic white and red windmill. The name means sunny fields in Danish, which is appropriate for the warm California weather. Number 5, St. Augustine, Florida. Since this city was founded back in 1565 by Spanish settlers, it's no surprise it's filled with Spanish colonial architecture, like cobblestone streets and balconies. It's also known as the oldest city in the United States. Number 6, Vail, Colorado. You're probably most familiar with this town for its amazing ski resorts, but did you know it was inspired by the town of Zermatt, Switzerland, which is located at the base of the Swiss Alps? That's why you'll find architecture like decorative balconies and detailed woodwork everywhere you look. Number 7, Pella, Iowa. The Dutch-style architecture and huge windmill located in the center of this quiet town are some of the reasons this Midwest city will make you feel like you're in the Netherlands. Insider tip, visit during May to experience the famous Tulip Time Festival. Number 8, New Orleans, Louisiana. Since the city was founded by French colonists and then ceded to Spain in the Treaty of Paris, it feels like a unique mix of both countries. The wrought iron balconies and the famous Jackson Square are both French influences. Number 9, Venice, California. It's impossible to ignore the comparisons between this California town and the famous one in Italy. Both are full of canals and bridges, except the waterways in the United States-based destination were man-made. Still, it's a sight to behold. Number 10, Tarpon Springs, Florida. Forget Santorini. This Gulf Coast town feels like it's a charming eastern Mediterranean island. Tons of Greek immigrants flocked here at the turn of the 20th century, and the town still prides itself on having the largest Greek-American community in the country. Number 11, Montpelier, Vermont. Named after Montpelier, France, this gorgeous town was founded in 1781 and is rich in history. Its French-style buildings and dazzling fall foliage make it a must-see. Number 12, Helen, Georgia. It's hard to believe this town is only 90 minutes from Atlanta. Located right next to the Blue Ridge Mountains, this city was transformed into an alpine-inspired village in the 1960s to attract more visitors. Number 13, Kansas City, Missouri. Since the Country Club Plaza in this downtown area was architecturally designed to mimic the city of Seville, you'll feel like you just walked off a plane and into Spain. The towers and courtyards might distract from the fact that you're more likely to find barbecue than tapas. Number 14, Herman, Missouri. This small town was handpicked by German immigrants for its close proximity to the Missouri River, which reminded them of their beloved Rhine River. The climate also made the location ideal for winemaking, and today there are tons of local wineries in the area. Number 15, Charleston, South Carolina. Even though this town is the definition of Southern, it's also filled with countless similarities to European cities, like grand churches, cobblestone streets, and short, colorful buildings. Not to mention it was named after King Charles II of England. Number 16, Holland, Michigan. The name of this town says it all. It's a little slice of the Netherlands and was founded by Dutch settlers back in 1847. It's also home to De Zwaan Windmill, which is the only authentic working Dutch windmill in the United States. Number 17, Fredericksburg, Texas. German immigrant settlers founded this town in 1846, which is why it's known for its mix of German heritage with Texan hospitality, an unbeatable combination. Throughout the town, you'll find tons of specialty shops and beer gardens. Number 18, Poulsbo, Washington. Poulsbo was founded in the 1880s by a Norwegian immigrant, Horgan Eliasson. Ever since, it's been known as Little Norway on the Fjord. Everything from the architecture to the beer halls to the annual Viking festival is inspired by Scandinavian culture. Soho, New York City, New York. While every neighborhood of Manhattan looks different, Soho specifically has a European vibe. Its column buildings and cobblestone streets will make you feel like you're in Belgium. In fact, the type of stone used is called Belgian block. Number 20, New Britain, Connecticut. This quaint little town has a big Polish influence. In fact, even the green points on top of the church resemble St. Andrew's Church in Krakow. Every year, New Britain hosts the Little Poland Festival, celebrating the country's best food, music, and dance. Number 21, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The City of Brotherly Love City Hall, built in the 1800s, is a French-style masterpiece. Its Victorian elements drew inspiration from both the Palais de Tuileries and the Louvre in Paris. Number 22, Natchitoches, Louisiana. As the oldest permanent European settlement of the Louisiana Purchase Territory, Natchitoches is a special town. French culture has remained there ever since its founding in 1714, especially in the historic landmark district. Number 23, Huntington, New York. There's a mini version of the Palace of Versailles right on Long Island. The French-style chateau, named Oheka Castle, is the second largest home ever built in America. Fun fact, the enormous estate is where Kevin Jonas got married and where Taylor Swift filmed part of her Blank Space music video. Number 24, Boston, Massachusetts. There's history on every corner of Boston, especially Acorn Street. It's one of the most photographed places in the city as it gives visitors a taste of Old England. The brick buildings, cobblestones, and lanterns all are reminiscent of the most charming parts of Britain. Number 25, Santa Barbara, California. Between the mountains and the beaches and the endless string of seaside homes, it's no wonder Santa Barbara is called the American Riviera. The bright, cheerful town gives off major southern France vibes. Those red rooftops, meanwhile, serve Spanish Mediterranean flair. Number 26, Lindsborg, Kansas. Lindsborg, founded in 1869, is also known as Little Sweden, USA. The town is filled with art galleries and restaurants that celebrate Swedish culture, as well as dala horses, an ancient folk art tradition. Swedish pioneers brought them to Lindsborg to remind them of their home country. Number 27, Newport, Rhode Island. Newport brings the romantic feel of the French Riviera to the United States. The elements of Nice, France can be seen in everything from the town's Gilded Age mansions to its seaside cliff walk. Number 28, San Francisco, California. Both the Golden Gate shape and bright red color is extremely similar to the Pont 25 de Abril suspension bridge in Lisbon, Portugal. The two areas even share a love of cable cars, pastel buildings, and waterside shops. Number 29, Hocking Hills, Ohio. Hocking Hills State Park is like Scotland's famous landscape, complete with its lush greenery and waterfalls as far as the eye can see. It's a beautiful spot to visit for a hiking adventure. Number 30, Old Town, Alexandria, Virginia. This adorable town was once a major port for colonial Britain, so it makes sense why the streets still have an English feel. The brick homes, tree-lined sidewalks, and small shops all add to the charm. Number 31, Washington, D.C. Once you know that a French architect named Pierre-Charles L'Enfant designed the city in the 1700s, it's hard to miss its Parisian influence. From its European-styled dome-shaped Jefferson Memorial to its many common gardens, the nation's capital could be the perfect place to feel far away. Number 32, New Ulm, Minnesota. If this New Ulm clock tower gives any indication, nearly everything in the town is inspired by Germany. The Gothic architecture, the famous Hermann Monument, the beer, it's all Germany all the time. Number 33, Portland, Oregon. It's been said that Portland has a Berlin-like feel with its Gothic-style St. John's Bridge and waterside buildings. Even the bike-friendly streets and love of beer all give off the German allure. Number 34, Oahu, Hawaii. The rolling turquoise waves and mountainous terrain of Oahu looks nearly identical to the Azores region of Portugal. If you're lucky enough to visit this island, be ready for tons of fishing, tall cliffs to climb, and plenty of relaxation. Number 35, Las Vegas, Nevada. While Las Vegas is no small town, it's the place to go to toss a coin into the Trevi Fountain without leaving the U.S. The iconic strip is filled with other international landmarks like the Eiffel Tower. Our next article by Amy Ettinger is titled, Letting Go of Fear to Find Freedom and Joy on Two Wheels. Remember joyful childhood days spent flying around on bikes, roller skates, or surfboards and pounding the pavement during hours of double dutch, basketball, or tennis? This summer, get inspired to get up, get out, and have fun with our series, Move Your Body, in which women share stories of channeling their inner child by diving into an activity they loved or yearned to learn as a kid. I live in an outdoorsy California town, and I started noticing more bicyclists than ever before. It created a deep longing to try riding again myself. Relearning to ride a bike at age 48 felt like a soul-fulfilling Hail Mary. In my mind, the odds were high that I would fail, but the risk of doing nothing and languishing was even greater. Staying still and not trying something new meant remaining unhappy with the status quo. I decided that drawing on skills that I'd once learned as a child might trick my brain from acting like an adult caregiver to a more playful version of myself. Dan, my husband of 18 years, has been sucked into a vortex of depression and anxiety that led to a 9-day stay in a locked psychiatric facility. The recovery was exhausting for both of us. I'd spent the past 6 months in an almost perpetual state of hypervigilance. We were still figuring out how to be around each other. I wanted my joy back. I wanted my balance. But I learned there were some things that couldn't be willed back into place. My anxious mom never let me ride when I was a kid. She grew up in New York City in the 1940s, where bicycling felt like a death-defying act. Under pressure from my dad, she let me learn on a red Schwinn that came with training wheels and a flower basket. I took the bike on the sidewalk up and down North Blaney Avenue in Cupertino, riding between two stop signs because I wasn't allowed to cross the street. But it was a skill my mom diligently ignored, squashing any hopes of bipedal independence. When I outgrew my Schwinn, I was never offered a replacement. I've spent more than 40 years of my life watching others perform the simple task of hopping on and off a bike to get to their destination. I assumed I'd always be the one left behind, that my fear would always be greater than my courage. I wanted more than anything to reverse that equation. It took me more than a month of online shopping for a light, foldable bike. It needed to be transportable because I wanted the option of popping it into the trunk and driving it to a bike path rather than riding in traffic. I found something within my budget, a red model Zizzo Urbano with a kickstand that looked like a futuristic version of my childhood Schwinn, and sent the link to Dan. Hell yes, he said as soon as he saw it. I'm buying this for you right now. It arrived in time for Mother's Day, a week before my birthday. I eyed the package suspiciously every time I passed it in the foyer. On Mother's Day, Dan unboxed it and put it together while I did yoga in our bedroom. By the time I said namaste, he'd taken it for a spin around the block and was grinning when he wheeled it inside. It had been a while since I'd seen him look so unguarded. Why don't you ride it out in the front, he asked. I don't want anyone to see me, I said. As usual, I wanted to hide my struggles. Instead, I took the bike out to a cramped concrete area in the back of my house where it was awkward to negotiate, but semi-private. I lowered the seat so that my feet could comfortably touch the ground. I raised the seat again. It didn't feel right. But for this to work, I needed to accept the uncomfortable. I put my feet on the ground and used them to scoot forward. Then I finally started to pedal, going back and forth over the same small section of concrete for half an hour, my hands cramping from gripping the brakes too hard. At one point, I lost my balance, stopping myself against the outside wall of the garage with my elbow. It immediately burned, and I thought, Mom was right. This is too dangerous. My daughter came outside, saw the bike, and hopped on without shoes or a helmet. This is fun, she declared. Can Daddy and I take a ride? He rolled his bike out of the garage, and they headed out into the street. I let them go, hoping that I'd be able to join them one day. I was happy they were having much-needed time together, but I also felt the echo of all the bike rides I'd been excluded from in my youth. The next day, Dan took me to the church parking lot down the street, where he taught my daughter to ride. I realized that I needed him to watch me to feel safe. It was a role reversal from how things had been between us for months, where I was highly attuned to his slightest change in mood, looking for any sign that I'd need to take him back to the hospital. I had a few moments of anxiety as the bike wobbled or I braked too suddenly. My brain was focusing on one thing, not falling. But I continued pedaling around the empty space of the parking lot, Dan cheering me on, running behind me to keep up. While I was riding, two little girls passed me by. One was probably 4 and still had training wheels. She looked fearless in her pink unicorn helmet. A doll was riding on the bike's baby seat. I envied both their speed and their fearlessness. But I was starting to gain confidence. Mostly, I felt exhilarated. In the days that followed, I started to relax a little on the bike. I remembered that there are worse things than tipping over. When my mom didn't let me ride when I was a kid, this was the most important lesson I'd missed. We can only learn our own resilience by the obstacles we face. I pushed myself to go a little further with each ride. I felt energized, and yes, still somewhat afraid. One evening, about a little over a week after I started riding again, Dan met me on the path by a nearby yacht harbor. He'd taken the bike on the streets while I'd walked. He handed me his helmet. I positioned myself on the bike. Arcade Fire's Lighting One was playing in my mind. I had just heard the single for the first time, and the lyrics, "We can make it if you don't quit on me, I won't quit on you, don't quit on me," were becoming a powerful personal anthem. I started pedaling and just kept going, past the dog walkers and the other bicyclists, over a speed bump that barely slowed me down. A great blue heron flew overhead. By the time I stopped, I turned around and Dan was off in the distance. "That was the most fun I've ever had on a bike," I said, beaming when he caught up. "I only stopped because I didn't want to leave you behind." Experts say we hold childhood traumas in our bodies, but I discovered we also hold the joys. Sitting on my bike, I felt a lightness and a long-lost sense of freedom that made me laugh with its unexpectedness. When I glanced over at my husband, I saw that he was right there smiling beside me. Our next article by Bethany Heitman is titled, "Dread Going to the OBGYN? These female founders want to change that." When her pregnancy test turned up positive in 2019, the first emotion Elise Thompson felt was overwhelming joy. But the 34-year-old says that happiness quickly turned to panic. "The pregnancy was planned. My husband and I wanted a baby," she says. "But I had a traumatic experience with an OBGYN in my 20s and had avoided them ever since. The thought of regular examinations and appointments terrified me." Knowing she was going to have to be visiting an obstetrician frequently throughout her pregnancy, Elise attempted to find a provider who would understand her past trauma and collaborate with her to get through her fears. "I searched online, hoping to find a practice that focused on sensitive, collaborative care and found nothing," she says. "In the end, I found a provider that always felt a little rushed and didn't care much about my emotional health. I survived the experience, but I wish it had been better." Elise isn't alone. A number of women report not being satisfied with their pregnancy care. In fact, when compared with other high-income countries, women in the United States report the least positive experiences in healthcare and are more likely to deal with emotional distress. A study from 2019 found that 1 in 6 women says they felt mistreated by medical professionals. Types of mistreatment include being ignored, refused, or scolded. But even if women don't feel mistreated, many wish there was a bit more holistic care connected to this vulnerable time. "Doctors are busy, I get it," said Debbie Fennerty, 42. "But when I was pregnant, I wish there had been more resources at my OBGYN's office. I could have benefited from nutrition advice during my pregnancy and pelvic floor advice afterward." This holistic approach to pregnancy care that women like Elise and Debbie longed for is exactly what OULA aims to provide. Billing itself as a modern maternity center, OULA was founded in 2019 by Chief Executive Officer Adrienne Nickerson, Chief Operating Officer Elaine Purcell, Chief Experience Officer Joanne Schneider, and Medical Director Ila Deamanda, MD. At the time, Nickerson, Purcell, and Schneider were all pregnant and noticed that expecting moms often had a subpar patient experience, and they were determined to change that. OULA's first location is located in Brooklyn, New York, and a second location is opening in Lower Manhattan soon. The founders say that these New York-based locations are just the beginning, and they have plans to open in other states soon. So what makes care at OULA so different? "We were going through our own pregnancies, and the care options we wanted just weren't there," says Nickerson. "It felt like you had to be on one end of the spectrum or the other. Either you were with an OB in a hospital, or you were with a midwife at home. We felt like there needed to be an opportunity that sat somewhere in the middle and provided the best of both worlds, if that's what you wanted. With this in mind, ULA offers a collaborative care model, bringing doctors and midwives together under one roof. According to the World Health Organization, expanding access to midwife-led maternity care is one of the most effective ways to reduce maternal mortality, lower C-section and preterm birth rates, and bring down healthcare costs. A 2014 study found that including midwives in healthcare systems could prevent more than 80% of maternal and infant deaths. But that's not the only difference that ULA hopes to make. Our model is really focusing on the experience and thinking about how we promote communication and trust so that communication mishaps don't happen at the real pivotal time of bringing life into this world, explains Purcell. Schneider says that even simple things practiced at ULA make a huge difference to patients. We asked our patients what they like about their care, and they've said things like, "Oh, your provider's actually asked for consent before touching me," she says. "I am so glad they're having a good experience, but wow, does that show you how low the bar is set?" With the goal of raising that bar, ULA sets out to support whatever type of birthing experience a patient would like to have. Whether that is medicated or unmedicated, or with a doctor or a midwife, it is important to note that ULA does not offer home birth services, but instead is affiliated with a New York City hospital. Beyond the actual act of giving birth, the founders believe that providing information and support are extremely important. We provide a lot of education throughout the pregnancy journey about the decisions that you have to make. There is so much misinformation on the internet, so we want to point people to reputable sources, says Schneider. We see our role as helping to guide you. We create videos, we email you, we're telling you things in your appointment, and we have a patient portal where each step of the way we're laying out the important things you need to know and the decisions you'll need to make. And the care doesn't end once you have a baby. As many first-time moms will tell you, those first few weeks can be a huge adjustment. The fact that you're just handed a baby and sent home is pretty overwhelming if you think about it. I still think it's wild that most practices hand you a baby and are like, "See you in 6 weeks," says Schneider. For me, those first 6 weeks were difficult. So at ULA, we focus on at least picking up the phone and making sure we're connected with patients in the first week. We want to see how you are doing and connect you with resources if you need them. We also have postpartum support groups. Another big difference? The ULA offices don't look like your run-of-the-mill medical offices. Their spaces are designed to make you feel more relaxed. Think plush leather couches, gorgeous art, and warm paint colors. It feels more like a posh home with medical equipment than a sterile office. But just because a space oozes luxury doesn't mean it's exclusive. Just the opposite. Nickerson, Purcell, and Schneider all emphasize the importance of inclusivity when it comes to good maternal care. We make sure our providers represent the diversity that is New York, therefore also having the impact on what our patient population looks like, says Purcell. We take insurance and Medicaid. We've heard time and time again, especially from patients who identify as individuals of color, that they feel disenfranchised by the current healthcare system and couldn't find a provider who looked like them or made them feel like they could speak openly and honestly. We felt a moral obligation to try and change that, to really blow up maternity care and rethink the entire experience. Because one thing we know for sure is that all people deserve this level of care. Our next article by Paula McLean is titled, "Inherited Trauma and How to Stop the Cycle." When I was young, anytime I was in public, in a restaurant, at the beach, or even waiting in line for the bathroom at the gas station, I was constantly seeking to recognize something familiar in strangers' faces. I was looking for my mother. And though I didn't remember what she looked like, I felt sure she could spot me, the skinny, curly-haired, freckle-nosed girl she had left years before. She disappeared in 1970 when she was 25, and I was the middle of three girls, 6, 4, and 3. One day, she and a boyfriend dropped us off at our paternal grandmother's house in central Fresno, saying they were going to the movies and would come back for us in the morning. Except they didn't. In the days that followed, there were whispers among the grown-ups about what to do with us. Whispers and waiting and bottomless sadness. I remember feeling quietly underwater while we waited for our father to appear. He hadn't been around in a while, and though our grandmother talked about him being away in the army, later we would learn he was actually in prison for trying to rob a drive-in movie theater with a butcher knife. Jail time was not new to him, we would discover, nor were violence and drug addiction. But for the moment, we believed he was our knight in shining armor who would whisk us away to a more secure life. Instead, he took us to the county building, where the three of us sat lined up on a bench in a long hallway, waiting quietly as he filed the necessary paperwork to surrender us to the California court system. We spent the next 14 years shuttling through a series of kinship placements and foster homes, always together, thankfully. Many of our placements were horrifying, exposing us to neglect, violence, and sexual abuse. We were throwaway children who belonged to no one, least of all ourselves. Each time we arrived at strangers' houses with our clothes and garbage bags, I wanted to believe things would change for the better. When they didn't, I spent years waking up in the middle of the night. I would go into the bathroom and stare at myself in the mirror. "Why is this happening?" I asked, searching my face for an answer to why no one kept us. "It's your fault," my reflection replied, the most obvious answer. I wish there were a way right now to reach out to that confused and terrified girl. I would turn her toward the mirror and tell her things she's never heard before, that she is precious and valuable, that she deserves to be safe and loved, that she's looking in the wrong place for the problems in her life. It didn't start with her or her sisters, who are simply children and have done nothing wrong, but generations before. A river of sorrow and unresolved trauma that weaves through family members she's never met, but who have struggled and thrashed in the same current. On June 13, 1925, 3 days shy of her 36th birthday, my maternal great-grandmother, Anna Esther Puglia McLean, died in a drowning accident in Oregon's Columbia River Gorge. Her 13-year-old daughter, Lorna, also drowned that day, a tragedy that profoundly altered the lives of the surviving family members, including those who hadn't been born yet, as if the lethal undertow wouldn't rest until it touched all of us. I've imagined that day 1,000 times. The sun-spotted water as children play, shrieking and splashing with glee. Then the tug of slipstream at Lorna's ankles. She thrashes breathlessly, full of raw terror, as her mother, who never learned to swim, jumps in and tries to save her. Both of them are quickly taken by the current, pulled under while others watch helplessly. My grandmother Clover was 10 when her mother and sister died. She and her younger sister were given up by their father, who decided he couldn't care for them, much the way my father did. Later, Clover would marry young to a violent and abusive man and settle with him near Spokane, Washington. They had 5 children, the youngest of whom is my mother, Rita, except not really. When Clover became pregnant with a 6th child, my grandfather told her that there were too many mouths to feed, that if she came home from the hospital with another baby, he would leave her. Forced with this impossible proposition, she gave the child up for adoption and returned to her family with empty arms. But she never forgave her husband, nor did she recover emotionally. A few years later, she boarded a bus east to erase one life and begin another. Her 2 sons stayed with their father. 1 sister was sent to live with a pair of maiden aunts who resided nearby. 1 married at 16. And my mother, at around age 9, eerily mirroring her own mother's experience, was sent to an orphanage. There are stories we know by heart and others that are closer to life's blood. Ones we live unconsciously, destined to repeat them. I might never have been aware of my lineage if my mother hadn't come back into my life, just as suddenly and bewilderingly as she disappeared, to eventually drop small shards of stories and clues to the past. It was the mid-80s by then, and my sisters and I had finally aged out of the system. We were living together in a dingy apartment with borrowed furniture, putting ourselves through community college with minimum wage jobs. Then a letter arrived out of the blue. Rita and some friends were going to be visiting California. She wanted to know if we were open to a visit. Honestly, my answer was no, but my sisters outvoted me. They wanted to hear what she had to say, and I felt I had no choice but to agree. She came to the door alone, dressed in a striped shirt and white pants. Her wavy hair, the same color as mine, was combed away from her forehead. Her eyes were chocolate brown like my sister's. Suddenly, I found myself hugging her, tugged at by chaotic, incoherent feelings. She took us to a crowded Mexican restaurant. There, over chips and salsa, with mariachi music playing over the hi-fi, she tearfully asked us about our lives, without explaining where she'd been all this while or why she'd left in the first place. We were too afraid to ask. Before the evening ended, she told us that she'd recently been at her mother's deathbed and made a promise, Clover's dying wish, that she would try and find us before it was too late. Rita seemed to want to know us, to make amends. We 3 had been struggling to keep our heads above water, and she offered to help. We could move to Michigan, where she was living with her husband, Jim, and go to school there. Before I knew it, we were all living together in a small Michigan town, daughters again. In many ways, life did get easier. I arrived in Michigan malnourished, weighing barely 100 pounds at 5'8". Without rent to pay, I could go to A&W every day for a root beer float. I could buy new clothes with my wages from Domino's Pizza. But family life was complicated. Rita and Jim were both employed by the same factory in a small one-stoplight town. They worked all day, then went out at night, coming home late to eat takeout in the kitchen after we'd gone to bed. They fought a lot, and not in whispers. Family meals were all but non-existent, let alone anything like intimacy or nurturing. My sisters and I enrolled in college, determined to finish. Then Jim left Rita for a much younger woman. Watching her come undone felt both familiar and terrifying, echoing against long-buried memories of the time before she left us, when our father was always out trying to get drug money or catting around. My earliest recollections were of trying to wake her in the middle of the day on the couch under a crocheted blanket, her hair over her face, an ashtray full of lipstick-stained spent cigarettes. But she wouldn't get up. After Jim left, Rita finally began to talk to us about the past, little by little. These were never whole stories, just small barbed puzzle pieces. Difficult truths she had clearly wrestled with and felt ashamed of. Like how her father once knocked out the teeth of his new wife after Clover left them. How she didn't finish high school because she followed her first husband to Virginia for a military assignment when she was 17 in an attempt to escape her life. How our father had never been faithful to her but threatened to kill her when he found out she had a boyfriend while he was in prison. That's why she left us in 1970, because she thought she was going to die. I wish I could say I felt freer listening to her. All those years I'd carried the weight of our abandonment, feeling like damaged goods, when in truth her departure had nothing to do with me. Our violent father had left her with 3 kids, no support, and few choices. Life itself had as well. She'd been abandoned by her mother and raised by strangers, just as we had. I could see her woundedness, feel the way it matched and chimed against my own. But really, I was still hurting, still the aching girl who'd been thrust into chaos and pain at the age of 4. It would take many more years and a hefty dose of counseling and psychotherapy before I could begin the long work of forgiveness. I had married and divorced and was nearly 40, battling with my ex-husband over custody of our 7-year-old son, when I learned the story of Anna and Lorna's drowning. The details sent a chill through me, and I made Rita repeat them. Anna had died just before she turned 36. I'd never struggled with any birthday except the day I turned 36, when I climbed into the shower and found I couldn't get out. I spent hours crying without knowing why, spinning over and over on the thought that I hadn't done enough or lived right, and that it was too late to change. I soon realized it was Anna crying that day through me. It was my grandmother on her deathbed and my mother on the couch, too sad or lost to get up. It was all of us swimming against the current of loss and grief. Knowing that trauma is knitted deeply into our cells, our DNA holds a lot of pain for sure, but also hope and forgiveness. From where I write at my desk, I can see the whole story, the beginning and the middle and the end. It's fallen to me and my sisters now to stop the cycle, to step out of the river and stay. Our children will never be motherless, not even when we die one day. That's what love does. That's called healing when a new story begins. Paula McLean is the New York Times best-selling author of the novels When the Stars Go Dark, out now in paperback, Love and Rune, Circling the Sun, The Paris Wife, and A Ticket to Ride. The memoir Like Family, Growing Up in Other People's Houses, and 2 collections of poetry. She lives in Ohio with her family. Our final article by Cassie Hurwitz is titled Oprah Pays Tribute to Serena Williams on Night 1 of the U.S. Open. Serena Williams' announcement that she will be retiring from tennis soon means one thing for the 2022 U.S. Open. This year's tournament will likely be her last time playing for that title. To celebrate Williams' final matches and of the Open, narrated by none other than Oprah. The video made its debut after Williams' first match, which was in round 1 of the women's singles. Williams won against Montenegrin player Danka Kovanic, winning 6-3, 6-3. The tribute begins with a bang, a 17-year-old Williams winning her very first U.S. Open in 1999. She's elated, pressing her hand to her heart before clearly saying, "Oh my God." Williams then walks over to her family, seeing her sister Venus and hugging her father Richard. This touching scene is followed by a sight familiar to many, Williams absolutely dominating the tennis court over the next two decades. Here, Oprah's words of appreciation come in. Lady O comments on how quickly the years have gone by while watching Williams win. "You've given us so much," she says in the video. "All we can do is thank you." The video goes on to show Williams' many successes, from her 6 U.S. Open singles wins to her incredible fashion choices on the court. "Thank you for changing the face of the game, for inspiring the next generation." The video shows Williams with her daughter Olympia, as well as with fans, famous supporters, and opponents to whom she has been incredibly gracious. "Thank you for thinking outside the lines and encouraging us to evolve," Oprah says, before giving one final message of gratitude. "Thank you for showing us how to love the sport and for always loving us back." Oprah ends the tribute by telling Williams that whatever the next stage in her life holds, we're here for the long haul. "We'll be watching," Oprah says. "With love, all of us." Their daughter Olympia, as well as with fans, famous supporters, and opponents to whom she has been incredibly gracious. "Thank you for thinking outside the lines and encouraging us to evolve," Oprah says, before giving one final message of gratitude. "Thank you for showing us how to love the sport and for always loving us back." Oprah ends the tribute by telling Williams that whatever the next stage in her life holds, we're here for the long haul. "We'll be watching," Oprah says. "With love, all of us." We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.